Welcome to Extreme Genes on the Mormon Channel, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
Kunta Kinte, you have found us. Hello, genies. It is Extreme Genes Family History Radio and ExtremeGenes.com. I am Fisher, your affable radio root sleuth. How are you? On the show today, Stan Lindis is back, our research authority, talking about the benefits of actually traveling to the special places in your ancestors' lives. And wait till you hear what he learned about one of the ancestral sites he visited and the remarkable story he could only have learned by going there. That'll be in about 9 minutes. Later in the show, another individual I would have to classify as an extreme genie. He is A.J. Jacobs. And he wants to hold the largest family reunion ever held next year in New York City. It's a Guinness thing. How many people are we talking about? Why are you invited? AJ will tell you. And you're going to love this guy. He has a very interesting approach to life. And, of course, Tom Perry will be back, our preservation authority, with part two of what you need to know about new and exciting family history uses for QR codes and memory medallions. But first, here's the latest family histoire news from the pages of ExtremeGenes.com. From the Akron Beacon Journal of Ohio, Henderton House in England is a gated community which has been around for a long time. Shortly before D-Day in 1944, an obviously American soldier carved a heart into one of the mansion pillars and wrote, "Caruso, Akron, Ohio." The carving has been well known to residents for decades, of course, and recently a few were visiting at a Christmas party when the subject of the carving came up. Who was this Caruso? One of them decided to find out. Phil Davis wrote and sent a letter to newspapers in Akron, Ohio, asking for any leads. The letter came to the attention of Angela Siegman Wachtecki, whose mother's maiden name was Caruso. The letter was shared with her uncle, Jim Caruso, whose father had served in England during World War II and passed away in 1993. Now, Jim keeps a box of his father's papers in the attic, so he rummaged through it and, wouldn't you know it, found two photographs of the pillars of Henderton House in England. The photo of the carving that was published along with the letter from England betrayed a unique handwriting that Jim was easily able to identify as that of his father, especially the letters C and R in Caruso. Jim noted that back in the 1960s, his father would carve hearts into trees and even put one on a copper bracelet he wore to fend off arthritis. Not long after his days at Henderton, Guy Caruso was one of the brave young men who fought at Normandy and eventually helped to reclaim Europe for the Allies. And yes, Jim is planning a trip to England to see his father's special artwork. And no, the Henderton people have no intention of removing it or seeking damages from the Caruso family. It'll be a special visit for Jim, who will no doubt be well received. See the link to the article and the photo at ExtremeGenes.com. Next, Rebecca Onion of Slate has some fascinating news concerning our first president. In 1873, a British genealogist named James Philippe presented to then-President Ulysses S. Grant a beautiful and artistic genealogy of George Washington. It is titled in flourishing letters at the top, "Pedigree of the Most Illustrious General George Washington, First President of the United States of America." At the bottom, Philippe wrote, "I humbly present it to the great American people at a national monument of their glorious country." Well, what he didn't humbly mention was that he had fabricated his eye-pleasing chart to gain favor in the eyes of President Grant. Philippe wasn't particularly popular in the British genealogical circles, as he once pronounced, "Nearly the whole of pedigrees hitherto published are fictitious." He added to that that he was the only living genealogist. Well, another genealogist, Henry Fitzgilbert Waters, with the assistance of Joseph Lemuel Chester, an American researcher who specialized in British lines, then took particular delight in debunking Philippe's Washington lineage. It appears that Mr. Philippe had made up two sons of a Leonard Washington, who he recorded as having crossed the pond in 1659. It was, in fact, a John Washington, son of Lawrence, who had come to Virginia in 1656, who was George's ancestor. It's not likely that President Washington would have cared too much about this. He once wrote concerning his ancestry, "This is a subject to which I confess I have paid very little attention." I guess we can add this to the throwing the silver dollar across the Potomac story and the whole chopping the cherry tree thing to the list of things untrue about our number one commander-in-chief. See the link with a picture of the chart. It is pretty at extremejeans.com. Well, our friends at BillionGraves.com have made a bold announcement that won't cost you a dime, but may one day soon bring you breakthroughs overseas. Billion Graves President Hudson Gunn is on our Extreme Genes Fine Line. Bring us up to date, Hudson.
What we did is we partnered with MyHeritage to make the Billion Graves app available all over the world. What they're going to be doing is helping us translate our application and website into over 25 different languages.
Wow.
And then in the weeks to come, yes. So we are very excited for this international expansion, as well as a new initiative with them to promote Billion Graves to their users, as well as tens of millions of users throughout the world, to document all of the cemeteries that they have nearby. We're making cemeteries big and small now accessible to the world.
Now, this 25 language thing, at first glance, you'd go, well, of course, it doesn't matter to me if I don't speak them, but it should matter to everybody, because that means you're going to have more volunteers who speak those languages and can translate that, getting to the graves in various cemeteries of mother countries everywhere. Right?
Correct. That's often a big part of the Headstone Challenge, which is finding native speakers who can translate it the way that it was supposed to be written, and then translated back of how we use that into our genealogy. So it's very, very important to have the native genealogists working together to help collect this information, because it just makes it that much more accurate.
And then you add to it your special app. Everybody gets the GPS coordinates. You could actually go visit your ancestors' graves in all kinds of countries you never thought of before.
Exactly.
Amazing stuff, Hudson. Thanks for your time and congratulations.
Well, thank you so much.
All right. And remember, our Extreme Genes Fine Line is there for you to share your exciting discoveries, your questions and comments with us. We'd love to hear from you. It's toll free. 1-234-56-GENES. That's 1-234-56-GENES, G-E-N-E-S. And on the way next, Stan Lindis, our preservation authority from heritageconsulting.com, with great discoveries from the trail and reasons for you to pay visits to your special ancestral locations. You're going to like this. On Extreme Genes Family History Radio and extremegenes.com. And welcome back to Extreme Genes Family History Radio, extremegenes.com. It is Fisher here, your radio root sleuth with our research authority, Stan Lindis from heritageconsulting.com. Hi, Stan. Welcome back.
Thanks, Fish. Great to be here.
This is a man who is always on the road. It's hard to keep track of where he's at, because you like to go to the places where the ancestors are, whether you're researching for yourself or others. Let's talk a little about that.
Well, going to the places allows you to really get the complete story. You know, we all collect stories about our ancestors, or we hope we can collect stories about our ancestors. And by going there, you can learn the feeling that they had. Well, let me give you a great example. A few years ago, my wife and I took a road trip all over the United States. I have an ancestor by the name of Joseph S. Preston, who was born in New York and served from Michigan in the Civil War on the Union side, and he was captured at Petersburg.
Uh-oh.
To quote him, he was mashed in the back with a rebel musket, which made it so that he couldn't get up and run. And so they caught him, put him in a prison camp, and then put him on a train to Andersonville, Georgia.
Oh, boy.
The hellhole of all of the Civil War prison camps. You look at pictures of some of these guys when they come out of Andersonville, and it looks like fellows that were in Auschwitz.
Yeah, I've read where, in fact, one of my wife's ancestors was in Libby prison, which was very similar.
Yes.
And they would pick the corn out of the horse manure.
Yes.
That was in there to survive.
Well, not only that, but they were so infested with fleas and other mites that they would pick the fleas off of one another in the morning, and they would fill a coffee can, and then they would cook the fleas.
Oh.
This guy was in there, and life expectancy once you went into the prison camp was about 3 months.
Now, wasn't the commandant of this camp, but wasn't he held for war crimes later, as I recall?
He was the only man who was executed for war crimes.
Huh.
Captain Wirtz. At any rate, so my wife and I go on this trip, and we're visiting various historical sites and family homesteads and such. We go to Andersonville, and it's very stirring to be there. The whole field is open. They have reconstructed from pictures and excavation the gates at Andersonville. We walked all the way around this facility, and it's a very large area. And the closer I came to the gate, my guts just started churning. We walked through the gate into the compound, and I was just moved to tears to think about the thoughts that these men had as they were walking through. And many of them were never going to walk through that gate again, making their exit. Now, my ancestor, interestingly enough, there's a grave there for him. But however, he lived for another 40 years.
Did he want his body back with his colleagues? How did that work?
No. How it worked was this, is that the Confederacy, being desperate for resources, would make agreements with foreign powers. Let's say the Polish government, and Captain Wirtz would announce on Monday that next Thursday that all Polish-born Union soldiers were going to be paroled, so that the Confederacy could curry favor from the Polish government. And so, in the meantime, every morning, these men were in squads, and they had streets laid out in this compound. And the men would take turns every morning going out and patrolling the streets, looking for individuals who had died that they might scavenge off of them anything of any value to preserve their lives. And if it so happened that the man that they found dead in the street was of Polish ancestry, then they would take his name and give it to the sickest man in the squad, and he would be paroled as though he were the man who was dead in the street, and the man dead in the street would be buried with the name of the man who was then paroled. Reading diaries of some of these men, that happened about the same time that my guy was paroled and showed up in a Union hospital in Virginia.
So you're telling me then that there's a grave with your ancestor's name on it because your ancestor gave his ID to this person to take the other person's?
Yes, they basically traded
it was a trade.
Names.
Okay.
And the Polish guy was buried with Joseph S. Preston's name. And Joseph walked out using the Polish name. I have no idea what that Polish name was.
Wow.
But there it is.
But what a story to come upon in researching your people and being there.
That portion of the story didn't just come upon. It took me years of digging in. And that's the most plausible explanation I have at this point based on diaries and other accounts of men who were in the compound at the time.
To why that would be.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly.
Wow.
Exactly.
That's
yeah.
great.
It's a tremendous thing to go and to be where they were. I have another ancestor for whom I had worked for years, and I'm still working, trying to find out who the daddy is. And this man's name is Thomas Pyle, and he lived in Kent County, England, in a small village called Bethersden. Went over there this spring. In 1839, there's a tithe map. In other words, the church wanted
right.
money from everyone, and they drew a map, a very detailed map, of every building in the parish. And they are numbered, and Thomas Pyle is listed on there. And then in the 1841 census, he's living at on a farm called Snowed Hill. And I had made arrangements to stay in a bed and breakfast near Bethersden. For some reason, I got a feeling like I shouldn't stay there. And I got online and looked, and the only thing that would pop up was the bed and breakfast at Snowed Hill Cottage.
Oh,
I thought this is a no-brainer. You know, I canceled my reservation at the other place, and we went there and stayed. And it was the house that he lived in.
You got to stay there.
Yeah. And as a matter of fact, the house was built using timbers from retired sailing ships. The house was built in 1450, so you can imagine that the timbers that I'm looking at in the wall and in the ceiling were cut and trimmed, who knows, in the early 1300s.
Yes.
Just mind-boggling. Their homes over there, some of them that they live in, make our old houses in the U.S. Look like new builds.
That's absolutely true.
Our historic treasures are new builds.
I did that in the village of Yarm, which is this little place along the Tees River, and that's where the Fishers came from, and found out that my fifth great had had his butcher shop and the home in what is now a pub. Toast the ghosts and go upstairs. We got invited upstairs to see the living quarters and to be there. And there is a different feeling when you're actually in the place that your people lived and worked and died sometimes.
Now, he may have slept quite soundly there.
Yes.
But the first night I was there, my mind was racing. You know, I couldn't sleep for beans. The stories about him coming to America, he immigrated in 1841, right after the census, went directly to Ohio, was living there, and I have found a description. He was one of the first settlers in the county, and there's a very, very detailed description of his cabin, which was about the size of two of the bedrooms in the house that he left in England.
Wow.
And his wife, as a matter of fact, she went kind of nutso because of the step down in society and in living conditions from that which she had in England to that which she had in Ohio with all the Indians around. And
That would be an adjustment.
I don't think she adjusted it. I think it killed her. So.
Wow. How old was she when she passed?
About 32.
Yes.
Yeah.
It sure sounds like it.
She went off the deep end and was lamenting about needing to go home and having no way to get there.
So tell me this, for people who are interested in going to some of the places that they've been researching, any special tips that people should be aware of and keep in mind?
Oh, yeah. You can always contact me at Heritage Consulting, and we'll help you. But you can do things yourself. There's so many resources available online. First, you need to pinpoint the location of the residence. And heaven's sakes, you can get on Google Earth for many of these places.
Yes.
And look at them.
At street level.
Yes, at street level. I did that with this house in Betherston and knew it when we got there, which is nice because you don't know where you're driving. For one thing, you're on the wrong side of the road, but there are directories that will give you exact addresses for most people. Of course, the censuses. We can go back to the tithe maps in England. There are things that you can do in Scandinavia. They have, in Norway, things called bygdebooks, which are farm books.
Bygdebooks,
yes. And they detail the history of the farm itself, and they have fabulous maps, extremely detailed maps, much like we talked about several months ago about the Sanborn maps, you know, showing where the outhouses and the carriages and everything were.
Right.
These maps are typical of that. And so you are able to find out about the place. And when you find out about the place, then you can look at the history of the location. And oftentimes you'll find references to your ancestor. It's a great, great way of becoming more intimately acquainted with and understanding, as an old Polynesian friend of mine used to say, the how come why.
Love that.
Yeah. How come why? Why did they move from here to there? What was going on in their lives? Understanding the society and getting a great feel for the geography on an intimate level.
Great tips, Stan.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll see you again soon.
Thanks, Fish.
Stan Lind is from HeritageConsulting.com. And coming up next, he's trying to assemble the largest family reunion in the history of the world. This guy is another extreme genie. AJ Jacobs from New York City coming up next on Extreme Genes Family History Radio and ExtremeGenes.com. Hey, welcome back to Extreme Genes Family History Radio, ExtremeGenes.com. It is Fisher here, your radio root sleuth. And on the line from New York City right now, we have AJ Jacobs, a new friend, met at Roots Tech. And AJ has kind of a different idea. How are you, AJ? Good to have you on.
Good to be here, Fisher.
He comes to me and says, hey, we want to have the largest family reunion in history. You want to make a Guinness World Record reunion at the Unisphere at the old 1964 World's Fairgrounds in New York. What are you thinking, AJ?
I'm thinking, by the way, everyone, you're invited. Everyone's invited, all 7 billion members of the UNA family. It started a few months ago. I got an email from a guy in Israel, and he said, you don't know me, but I'm your 12th cousin. And he said, I have a family tree with 80,000 of your other cousins. And I didn't know what to make of this. You know,
what?
Part of me said, I have enough trouble handling my current family. Do I really want 80,000 more relatives?
What is it they say? You can't choose your family, right?
Well, yes. Well, now you can because I have so many. I can choose which ones. Another part, I said, you know, this is amazing. I'm connected to all these people all over the world. So I immersed myself in genealogy. I knew nothing about it, but I caught the bug, and I realized it's going through, as you know, this fascinating period, partly because of DNA testing and partly because of these sites where you can do collaborative family trees with other people, sites like Genie.com or WikiTree, and you have hundreds of people working on the same tree, and you get these mega trees with thousands of people on them. And one site, Genie.com, which is part of MyHeritage, has the World Family Tree, which has 75 million people on it.
And so you looked at this and said, hey, let's get everybody together.
Exactly. Listen, the point is, this really drove home for me, we're all related. Everyone in the world is all, it's the 6 degrees of separation
right.
Idea. And I found on this tree that I'm related, and I'm not boasting, because everyone is. I'm related to Albert Einstein. He's a mere 19 steps away, Gwyneth Paltrow is just 22 steps away from me. So I'm going to invite her and hope she comes to the reunion to brings her vegan turkey casserole.
I'm going to brag a minute, though, AG. I just found out this week that I am related to Lizzie Borden, who gave her dad 41 wax and her mother 40
sure.
more, or whatever it was.
All right.
That was kind of strange. Lizzie won't be coming.
I have some black sheep in my family as well, and, you know, just makes it more spicy.
Absolutely.
More
so how many people is it going to take to set the Guinness World Record?
The current record is about 4,500 people, a family in France.
Okay.
And so I'm hoping for at least 5,000. And it's also going to be live streamed, so people can call in from all over the world. And
Wait a minute. Does that count, though? I mean, the people who see it on the live stream, does that count towards your total?
Well,
or is that
going to
be a separate category?
I'm going for a whole other world record of the most people watching the most people in a virtual family reunion.
Ah, so, I didn't know there was such a category. You're making a new one?
Yeah, why not? I'm pioneering all sorts of things. Most people to sing We Are Family. I'm hiring Sister Sledge to sing at the reunion, so there'll be music and speeches, and we've got some great speakers. Dr. Oz has agreed to come. He's a very distant relative. We share the same J haplogroup.
Okay.
And Galad Jafet from MyHeritage. And you, Fisher, I would love to have you come and give a talk.
Well, I wouldn't have any problem doing that. I just got to make sure I'd probably be distracted by the Mets, which are right next door. That was the team I grew up with. But I got to ask, though, how does one rent the World's Fairgrounds?
Well, this is, right now it's, the World's Fair has the Hall of Science. It's called the New York Hall of Science, and it's an amazing museum. And it's got like a science-themed playground for kids, and it's got all these great exhibits. And they do these events, and they agreed, they liked the idea. So that's where it's going to be. It's going to be part inside and part outside. It's actually also a fundraiser for Alzheimer's, because that runs in my family and in the human family. So it will be free, but we're going to try to raise money.
So are you making this a whole weekend, or is it one day? How does this work?
It will be a whole day from 9 in the morning till 7 at night. It's a Saturday, June 6, 2015. And by the way, people, if you go to my website or email me, ajjacobs.com or aj@ajjacobs.com, I'll figure out how we're related so you can come. And it will be...
Hold on, wait a minute. Are you telling me that for everybody who comes, you have to prove the relationship?
Well, everyone is invited. It's open to the public.
Sure.
But
yeah.
If we can have a proven relationship, you get a bracelet, and then you get to be part of the biggest family photo ever.
Whoa. And what's the record for that?
You know, I'm not sure. That's another good question.
You're gonna, boy, you've got a lot of work ahead of you. If you're going to get this done by June of next year...
I'm already getting a nice response. You know, I've emailed a lot of my cousins who didn't even know they were my cousins, and some of them say, you know, is this a scam? What are you doing? Or I don't want any more cousins. I don't want to meet 5,000 cousins. But a lot of them have said, you know, this is going to be great. This, I can't wait to meet these people I never knew. You know, party, what can I bring?
That brought up some interesting points. If we do come, what would you like us to bring? Should we be on the salad committee, the dinners? How does that work? Should we bring stories to tell?
Yes, and stories would be great. It's not going to be potluck. You know, there will be food there, so don't worry about that. Just bring yourself and email me beforehand just so we can figure out the link. And then you'll get to meet all of these cousins. And the filmmaker Morgan Spurlock is who made the Super Size Me about McDonald's. He's going to make a documentary about it, so you can be on in the film if you want. Yeah, I am just super excited to meet all of my cousins who I've never met.
Now, I got to ask you, AJ, what do you do for a living?
Well, partly this. I'm writing a book about this, and so that's where I'm able to, you know, use part of my book advance to fund the reunion. And I've written several other books. I sort of take on these big projects, self-improvement projects. I did one where I read the entire Encyclopedia Britannica from A to Z to try to learn everything in the world. And I did another where I tried to live by all the rules of the Bible for a year, so the Ten Commandments.
What was the hardest one?
Well, there were a couple hard ones. I mean, first, there's the Bible says you cannot gossip or lie or covet. And I'm a journalist in New York City, so that's pretty much my life.
Right, lying, yes.
Lying and gossiping and coveting. So that was a big challenge. And then there were ones that were, you know, in the Hebrew scriptures, it says you have to stone adulterers. So that was a challenge today. So I used very small stones, like pebbles.
Oh.
That's sort of how I was able to.
How would you find the adulterers?
Well, I'll tell you, the guy I did end up stoning, he came up to me because it was sort of the middle of my project, and I was really getting into it. So I even looked like a biblical person. I had a huge beard and a robe and sandals, and I was in Central Park, and he came up to me, and he said, well, why are you dressed like that? And I said, I'm trying to follow all the Bible, from the Ten Commandments to stoning adulterers. And he says, well, I'm an adulterer. Are you going to stone me? And I said, well, yeah, that would be great. Thank you for the offer. And I took out a handful of stones. I'd been carrying stones around waiting for this moment. And they, as I mentioned, they were very small stones. And he was very aggressive. He grabbed the stones out of my hand and threw them at my face. So I thought, well, the Bible does say an eye for an eye. So I tossed one back at him. So that's how I checked that off my list.
But, wow, and you wrote a book on that.
Yes, exactly.
You are an interesting person, AJ. I hope this thing goes the way you planned, because, you know, family reunions don't always go so smoothly.
No, it could be a disaster.
It could be awful.
The fun of it.
Could be terrible. And by the way, I do not want to be on the hotel committee for this, trying to get rooming for everybody.
Okay? You got it.
All right. He's AJ Jacobs. He's putting together the biggest family reunion in the world for June of 2015 in New York City. And to get in touch with you once again, AJ, to be a part of this, where do they go?
Either my website, which is ajjacobs.com, or just email me directly at aj@ajjacobs.com.
He's at least the most interesting man in New York City. Thanks for coming on, AJ.
Thank you, Fisher. Loved it.
And coming up next, Tom Perry is back, our preservation authority from tmcplace.com, with more great information on how to make sure the heirlooms you've been given are still around for generations on end. On Extreme Genes, Family History Radio, and extremegenes.com. Hey, welcome back to Extreme Genes, Family History Radio, extremegenes.com. Fisher here with Tom Perry, our preservation authority from tmcplace.com. Welcome back, Tom.
Good to be back.
You know, we're always asking people to send in their questions to asktom@tmcplace.com, and we've heard from Esther Allen, and she writes, Tom, I've been catching up on episodes of Extreme Genes at Work, just discovered it last week, and I love it. Thank you, Esther. I've been helping my dad reminisce into a digital recorder, but I've realized that it has no cables or other equipment that will let the tracks download easily into WAV files or other computer-friendly formats. I'd love to save Dad's voice, especially since he has a very distinctive voice and storytelling style. Do you know of any way I'd be able to save that before it is deleted?
Absolutely. You want to be really careful with these digital recorders. I love them. They're awesome. They're easy to use. But one thing that really gets scary, people always think tapeless is better. Sometimes tapeless isn't better, because if you have a tape, you can always store it on your shelf. You can go back to it. It's always going to be there. But on the digital recorders, you can accidentally hit the delete button, send them through an X-ray machine, set them on top of a big speaker, and they go away. So they're really, really scary. So the first thing you want to do is make sure you get it on another format. And even though it didn't come with cables, generally they will have like an earphone jack. And so what you can do is go to Radio Shack or any place and buy an adapter that will plug into the earphone jack that then you can plug into your CD recorder, plug it in your computer or something like that, and then just transfer it to a CD. And like we've always said, you always want to store things on at least three media. I suggest a hard drive, a disk, and the cloud. So once you download it to your computer, you can make it an MP3, AIFFs, whatever you want. If you're a do-it-yourself person, if not, send it in to us, and we'll be more than happy to put it on a CD for you or an MP3 or any format that you prefer.
Well, that is great advice. And you mentioned the cloud. You've also mentioned previously to have more than one cloud.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I use Dropbox myself. There's a lot of good cloud services out there. I use a little bit on the one that Apple owns. But most of my stuff is on Dropbox. It's so easy to access. I can get it on my phone. I can get it on my iPad. I can get it on my computer. I don't have to carry around different devices with me, you know, because, oh, it's on my phone. I need to go there. It's very, very convenient. But I always say keep it on a disk, keep it on a hard drive, keep it in the cloud. And if you have it in those three places, you should be taken care of. And if you do disks, send them across the country. So you want to make sure you have it in different zones. Because, as I mentioned on a story before, we had a family that had their wedding photos in their own home. They had copies in their parents, and also the wedding photographer all had them. The only problem is, even though they lived miles away from each other in New Orleans, when Katrina came through, they lost it all because the entire city was flooded.
And this is kind of our part two on these memory medallions you were teaching us about last week. These are they're like little coins, I guess, that are on gravestones in cemeteries. And they work like QR codes with your smartphone, and you can find out about people who are buried as you come across them.
Exactly. It's just a little square code. It almost looks like somebody scribbled on it. But you shoot it with your smartphone, and it'll bring up all kinds of information. And the memory medallion, which you were mentioning, that's on headstones, there's other uses for this as well. Plus, they have a little one that you can wear on your wrist. It's like a bracelet or a locket. So if you're in an accident and the EMT has his smartphone, which they do, they carry those, they can actually shoot that memory medallion. And based on what you want to be there, you could have your x-rays. You could say you have an artificial heart. You have a replaced knee. Any information you want on that would be immediately available to not only the EMT that's training you, but to the hospital that you're going to. So when you get there, they'll know, oh, you know, he's had a heart implant. He has internal hearing aids, whatever, that's going to help the medical people treat you better and safer.
So the memory medallion people make these?
Uh-huh. It's a bracelet that you just wear on your wrist, or they also have lockets. And it has a QR code built right into it, and you are in charge of the information, like I mentioned. So there's not stuff on there that you don't want. You put the stuff on there that you want, whether it's your x-rays, medical information, whatever. So it's immediately accessible to the medical providers, whether it's the EMT or the hospital.
Boy, those few minutes saved could save a lot of lives.
Oh, absolutely.
The question is, though, are these EMTs around the country all familiar with this? Are they trained to know or to look for these things already?
I'm not sure if they are actually trained. Most of these guys are pretty smart, and a lot of these guys are younger that grew up on this kind of technology. So if they saw that, I'm sure they would pull it out and say, hey, this is interesting, let me shoot it. And I'm sure as they become more and more popular, they will probably be part of their training to know to look for those things. Because my father was allergic to penicillin, for instance, and he had a little...
I am too.
Yeah, had a little medical alert thing, and all it said was penicillin. Didn't say, is it amoxicillin or just penicillin? What all is he allergic to? With this, they shoot it, anything you want to come up there. Who you need to contact, your next of kin, if it's a really bad accident. If you've even decided that you want to donate your organs, that can be contained in there. You can actually put a photo of the card that you've signed. It's unlimited the amount of information you can put on these things.
Because it connects back to a website just like the memory medallions at the cemeteries.
Exactly. As long as there's Wi-Fi or internet, so if somebody has a cell phone, pretty much it's a given that they can connect to it. And it's just, It could save lives, many lives.
All right, what else do you have?
Okay, some other uses for these are really incredible. In fact, over in Iraq, where the troops are fighting, they have a QR code like a memory medallion on the tanks, but they're actually encrypted, so not just anybody with a smartphone can read it. You have to have an encrypted one. So, for instance, the guy that works on the tank gets killed in battle, the guy that's next in line can take his phone with the special information, shoot that QR code, and it brings up the schematics of the tank. So
wow.
He can go and fix it. I have seen places that are tourist attractions that are open like from 8 a.m. to 9 p.m. And say you're driving through at 3 o'clock in the morning, but you want to take a self-guided tour. You pull out your smartphone and you go and like click on all the different houses or whatever there happens to be. And it'll go in and say, okay, this used to be, you know, Thomas Jefferson's house. He lived here and then, you know, he moved. He did these kind of things. And you can take a self-guided tour right through that place.
I'd love to see these on baseball players' uniforms. I can snap the picture, get their stats in my smartphone right there as I watch the game. This is good stuff, Tom.
That is totally doable. They could put it on the back of their uniform, and you in the stands could zoom in with your phone, scan it, and it would bring up their stats.
You heard it here first. He's Tom Perry from TMCPlace.com, our preservation authority. That's it for this week. Thanks so much to A.J. Jacobs for joining us on the show. Good luck, A.J., with the world's largest family reunion. Stan Lindis with some great research advice as well about going to your ancestors' locations. We'll talk to you again next week, and thanks for joining us. And remember, as far as everyone knows, we're a nice, normal family.
This has been Extreme Genes on the Mormon Channel, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Share your family story by going to FamilySearch.org.